a new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes, to everything that's gay. If you are not there, ah, to share each lovely day. And through the years, and those moments when we're far apart, don't you know I'll close my eyes?
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents.
And hello again. You are listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM, broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. I'm author of Pen on Fire, and I am back. I've been gone for, what, 2 weeks? I don't know. I'm losing track. But I'm here this week, and as always on this show, we talk about writers and writing, the business of writing, the art of writing. The show features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing all of these things. And today we have an excellent show. We have on Jana Malamud Smith and Harriet Chessman. My first guest is Jana Malamud Smith. She's the author of two New York Times notable books, A Potent Spell and Private Matters, which was a Barnes & Noble Discover Great New Writers pick. She has written for the New York Times and the Boston Globe, among other publications, and her current book is called My Father is a Book, a memoir of Bernard Malamud. Let's bring on Jana. Hi there.
Hi.
Great to have you on. I must say, I've sort of been curious about this book from when I first heard about it, because I remember reading some of your father's books, The Natural, I believe, and
yeah.
Fixer.
Yep.
And I just loved his work. And then, you know, years go by, and here is your book about you and about him, and written in such a beautiful style. It's you have such a wonderful voice and literary style. Will you talk about this book coming to be?
How it came to be?
Yeah.
Sure. You know, I suppose the joke in my family would be, among my husband and sons, would be that this book has probably been my whole life coming to be. But in a realer way, when my father died 20 years ago, my first feeling was how private that experience of my grief was about his death, and how much I really hoped that other people wouldn't quickly start writing about him. And at the same time, I knew that at some point I would really want to write about him because he'd been so huge in my life and so formative in so many ways, and he's somebody I love so much and who loved me a lot. And it just felt more and more as time went on that writing was the way I was going to have to try and understand him and understand my experience of him.
Interesting. So, but for a good many years, you just wanted no part of any sort of book like this out there.
No, really, that's really true. And I think it was for a lot of reasons. I think that part of it was he just got so famous when I was a teenager that I just wanted to get out from under. It's sort of like living under an intense series of sun lamps, or, you know, that I wanted to get out of the brightness of his fame. And so when I was a young adult, one of my first jobs was I worked as a social worker in a housing project for 15 years, just to prove to myself that I could kind of do things in the world and make connections with people that were just sit completely apart from being his daughter. And I think as time went on, I understood that I couldn't live without writing, and so I was writing more myself. But I also became clear about who I was, and time passed. And my mother, whose privacy I was also protecting, got to the point where all of a sudden I realized she was so old that she could die, and I would never have the opportunity again to check out with her my memories and get her to at least provide a counterpoint and to correct me. Mm. And so a balance tipped across 20 years. I grew older. The material didn't feel so hot to me in some way. It felt manageable. My mother's memories became more precious to me about my father. All those things happened, I'd say.
Interesting. I'm talking with Jana Malamud Smith, author of My Father is a Book, a memoir of Bernard Malamud. This seems to me, at least in how I'm reading it, to be as much about you as about your father.
I think in part it is. I mean, I think there are some chapters that are really just about him. For example, I try to look at his early journals and understand how he became a writer, which is something that fascinates me since the deck was sort of loaded against it. You know, he grew up so poor. There was so much mental illness in his family. His father was a storekeeper. That it just seems amazing to me that he became the famous writer he decided at 15 he was going to be. So I look at his journals quite a bit in one chapter in order to understand the process through which he taught himself how to write and sort of created himself in certain ways. And then there's a chapter of his correspondence with my mother when they first meet, and a chapter of his correspondence with my father when my uncle becomes insane. So there is a chunk of the book that's just focused on him. And then starting when I was born in Oregon, the book becomes more of a sense of how he seemed to be to me.
Hmm. Interesting. Will you read to us?
I would love to. The first chapter of the book is called Early Stories, and it's a mix of the stories that he used to tell me at bedtime and early stories about his life that I found out as I started writing the book and learning more about him. He was very, very private about his past. It had been very painful to him, and he didn't like to talk about it. But this chapter mixes all these kinds of stories up. Early stories. For some period of years, starting when I was little, my father used to put salve along my eyelids at night before I went to bed. The tiny prescription tube of medicine was meant to treat an inflammation that the adults could see, but of which I was oblivious. Seated on the couch in the living room of our small house in Corvallis, Oregon, I would lean my head back, and he would carefully, gently, steadying his hands on my face, lower my lid and squeeze a thin line along its inner edge. I liked his care, but I disliked the ritual, and particularly the way the ointment temporarily disarmed me, Vaseline on a camera lens. I disliked, too, the requirement that I stay still while it melted in. To ease my impatience, he would tell me stories. Some were short, others were serial creations, miniature novels or movie segments that unwound across nights. As a boy, he had loved silent films, studied them to learn about storytelling in America. His first glimpses of a landscape beyond Brooklyn had likely been brought to him by the flickering reels that each week miraculously projected comic melodrama and then left the audience hanging, eager for 7 days to pass. One episode would end starkly with a villain harassing a maiden he'd bound to the tracks, a train steaming toward her around a blind curve. The next, the following Saturday, would begin with a knot-cutting hero galloping onto the scene. Dad had captured their technique and knew how to hold my attention. When, as an adult, I once asked about his childhood, he started telling me how he had relished going to the movies as a boy. When penniless, he had sometimes half-conned, half-stole tickets to get into a local theater. Quickly embarrassed, he stopped himself midway through the recollection. I was in my 30s. Even then, he remained reluctant to talk about his early life, its pains and contradictions, still unmanageable on his tongue. He wanted to be an exemplary father. He taxed himself hard to provide his children with what he had not had: stability, comfort, protection from the worst emotional horror. He worked to get daughter love completely right. He took on his duties earnestly, repeatedly considered how one might frame the world to a child. His real memories were often too broad for the archway of his paternal propriety, his code of acceptable self-revelation. Few squeezed through.
Thank you so much. That was Jana Malamud Smith reading from My Father is a Book, a memoir of Bernard Malamud, published by Houghton Mifflin just recently.
Yep, just this spring.
Just this spring. How do you, or how did you decide what to leave in and what to leave out?
Well, that's such a good question and such a hard one about any book. You know, part of the reason that one writes books in many drafts, or at least I do, and my father, I think, did even more, is you kind of try to work that out in part by trial and error. And so some of it is aesthetic, what makes the story work. In terms of the privacy things in my family, it was very clear that my brother did not want to be even mentioned as existing in the book, so I wrote only the most minimal amount about him, something that some readers and some critics have been really unhappy about. And it was clear that I wanted my mother particularly not to feel violated by the book. So when I finished the book, or the second draft of the book, before I let anybody read it for publication, I brought it to her, and she's 88, and I guess she was maybe 87 at the time, and I said, I'd like you to read this, and I'd like you to tell me whether or not I have permission to publish it. And she did, and she asked me to change the names of a couple of living friends of hers in Vermont, to take out their names, because she was wanting to protect them a little bit from the stories about their partners' infidelities and things like that that I had told.
Interesting. There's little dialogue in this book, mm-hmm. and I've been reviewing recordings for panels from the ASJ conference last April. One of them was on writing memoir, writing essays, writing personal stuff, and one of the bits of advice was if you're writing a memoir, do not include much dialogue. If only include lines that you really need to include, because as an agent and editor look at this, if there's too much, they're going to say there's no way they could possibly have gotten all this right.
Right. Well, what you're saying fascinates me, because in some ways, for example, one of the fine members memoirs is Tobias Wolff's This Boy's Life, which
yes.
is like 80% dialogue. But I think that in fact, I completely agree with the advice, which I've never heard before you said it. And the reason I agree with it is, I mean, think in my situation, writing about a man who's been dead 20 years, the core ethic or value of a memoir is you try as hard as you can to remember accurately and to speak that truth which memory can give forth. And unless you're, you know, some kind of idiot savant, I think, the actual conversations that went on a really long time ago tend to be lost to history.
Mm.
So I was careful that way, and I'm so of that school of memoir that believes that it cannot be fiction. Fiction is fiction, but if you're going to write memoir, what you have to bear is the nuance, the pain, the weirdness of the truth, and trying to tell it on yourself.
Now, why? I mean, I find it curious that you're mostly writing about your father. Although, as I said, I find that I learned a great deal about you. But why memoir and not biography?
Well, partly because I just, when I set out to write the book, I realized that I couldn't become his biographer, that was still felt burdensome to me, I think, in some way. I'm not sure I can even now put my finger on it. It just felt big And I also worry that the friends he had, of which there were many, would feel inhibited in telling their stories to me, that they would sort of, you know, try and protect me or try and tell me a partial story. And, of course, stories are always partial. But I thought that somebody who wasn't related to the family would probably get a better view of things. And also, you know, a biography really wants to be very objective, and a memoir doesn't have that duty. It has other work it has to do. So I left the biography to somebody else who's actually writing one now.
You said it has other work to do. Will you elaborate?
Yeah. The work of, as I experienced it, what I tried to do, I don't know if you or your listeners know the photographs of Walker Evans.
But, oh, yeah.
I really love his photographs. And when I was young and read James Agee's book, Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, those photographs just knocked me out. And what I loved about them, if you haven't seen them, is that they are straight on efforts to capture the street as the street is and the face as the face is. They don't muck with anything. They don't doctor anything. They don't shadow anything. They don't change the light in the dark room or any of those things. They try and capture it as best as they can. And I think that that's my sense of memoir, is that you're trying to do almost like a daguerreotype or a glass negative, something that tries to show the reader the best portrait of the person that you can write. And what you bring to bear on that is the fact that you knew the person intimately. And that's what the biographer usually doesn't so much have. So that the biographer, in turn, sort of tries to fill in a lot of context that I'm not sure the memoirist always has to do as completely.
Hmm. You're listening to Writers on Writing. We've been with Jana Malamud Smith, author of My Father is a Book, a memoir of Bernard Malamud. Had he ever had any conversations with you about writing about him in the future?
Not so much about me writing about him in the future. I mean, I think he was really, really, really ambivalent about biography. I mean, I think there was a part of him, he was very private. He was incredibly troubled, pained by his personal past. His mother became insane and died in an asylum. I think this was just heartbreaking for him. His one brother then became insane and had a very limited life. And those two losses really marked him in very serious ways that I write about in the book. And I think there's a part of him that just never wanted anybody to touch that again, that it was safe for him to touch that in fiction. But he didn't want it touched, certainly while he was alive. And I'm not sure that part of him even wanted it touched in other private aspects of his life when he was dead. At the same time, he was really proud of what he had achieved. And I think there was another part of him that probably would relish having been written about. And also that his last big novel, he wrote several after this, but his last big novel was called Dubin's Lives and was a novel about a biographer. So clearly he had thought a whole lot about it. You know, so I think, and he loved reading biographies. I can remember I read Walter Jackson Bates' biography of Keats because he had loved it. Lionel Trilling's autobiography because he had loved, Leonard Wolfe's autobiography because he had loved them. I mean, there were lots of biographies in my house when I grew up, and he loved to read about writers. So I think he just was torn about it.
Interesting. How was it for him and for the family, I guess, but especially for him when The Natural was made into a movie?
He was old enough at that point that he was just really delighted and amused about it. I mean, I think the success of it really, I think, caught him a little bit by surprise because a lot of his books have been made into movies and most of them have sort of died very quiet deaths. So to have Redford do this and to have it so take off, I think, was a complete delight for him. The other thing there are two other pieces of that. One is that, of course, my father's novel, The Natural, does not end as happily as the movie.
Mm.
And so it's quite a change from the story Dad wrote. But I think he was old enough that he just could take that in stride. He didn't feel like, oh, God, they've messed with my work. I'll never forgive them. He just thought, all right, well, this is America. This is what happens. But the second thing was, my mother remembers, and I, in order to understand the meaning of this, you have to understand that one of the things that my father didn't like was when people would call him a Jewish writer. And it wasn't because he didn't want to be Jewish. It was because he didn't want to be put into a box that to him felt somewhat marginalizing, as I think it probably does if you say a woman writer or a Latina writer or whatever those categories are that we use. He wanted to be a writer, and he wanted to be an American writer. And the night he went to see The Natural and he walked out with my mother, he turned to her and he said, "Now I am an American writer."
Mm. Ah, interesting. Oh, we have another few minutes left with Jana Malamud Smith. Again, her book is My Father is a Book. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. And gosh, I want to talk a minute, especially before we go, in terms of the voice. It's apparent from the start. It's such a lovely, just such a literary slant on your story. And I wonder if that is simply your voice or if that was the voice for this book.
The other books that I've written have more thought in them in terms of, you know, I had to read many, many books in order to write them. So there are a little bit more books of ideas in part. And so the voice in this book could be a little bit more that way. But I honestly think that what you're reading is just really my voice. And I think the literary part of it is probably what has happened to me after being my father's daughter all these years, where I was raised by parents and particularly by a man who believed that literature would change your life, that books would bring about a moral and an intellectual awakening that would make you much more of a human being than you could be without them, and that you had to read and read. And so I grew up reading and loving books, and when I was a young adult, I memorized a lot of poetry. And one of the things I would say to young writers is memorize poetry. Get the cadence of other people's language in your head. And that becomes, I mean, I think that's why some of the 19th century Renaissance American writers are so wonderful, is they had the cadence of the Bible in their head. I mean, you have to have a good cadence in your head.
That is so interesting. I don't think I've ever heard anyone say it quite like that. That's great advice. Another thing before we go, I'm curious, you know, growing up with a parent who was an author, how did that affect you? Were you going to be a writer? Were you headed in some other way?
My primary job still is I'm a psychotherapist. So in truth, my work life has always been split. I don't think that while my father was alive, I had a sense that I dared to write. I mean, not only is it so foolhardy to write when you're the child of a famous writer, because you know that however well you do it, you're never going to be as good as they are, and that's you have to live with that publicly all the time. So that's very daunting, and I think I ran from that for a long time. And I also felt, I think while he was alive, that he just needed somehow, there was some part of him I worried just wouldn't have space for another writer in the house. I'm not sure that was really true of him, but it was a fantasy I had about the situation.
Interesting. We're at the end of our time. I wonder if you have any advice for the writers listening who are perhaps working on a memoir.
The one piece of advice I would have is my father used to say all the time that his success was 10% talent and 90% effort.
Mm.
And one of the happiest days of my writing life was when some friends of his who were working on his work said, you know, we just found 17 drafts of one of his stories over in the Library of Congress. And I thought, oh, my God, 17 drafts. There's a lot of hope in 17 drafts.
That's so interesting. I love that, too. It's been great talking with you.
I thank you so much for having me.
And continued great luck on this book.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Take care now.
That was Jana Malamud Smith, author of My Father is a Book. Wonderful, wonderful book. Wonderful memoir about Bernard Malamud. Stay tuned. When we return, we will be with Harriet Chessman. Don't go away.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. One belt in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Weekly Signals, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Join me, Mike Hasper, and Nathan Callahan for the best in reality-based radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
And you don't hear none of those stations playing them. Ask why. In fact, where are those stations today? Somebody better ask somebody that. The people that's most affected by this war.
From animal rights and the anti-war movement to civil disobedience and culture jamming, Justice or Just Us examines law, equality, public policy, and social activism. Tune in Thursdays 8 to 9 a.m. on KUCI in Irvine and KUCI.org.
Writing, hosted by Barbara DeMarco Barrett on Thursdays at 5 p.m. on KUCI FM in Irvine. Bye-bye.
Yee-haw!
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're at the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're on the web at kuci.org. We are broadcasting all over the planet, and it's wonderful to receive your emails and hear from you in other parts of the country and the world listening to this show. Thank you. Thank you for doing so. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and first half of the show, we were with Jana Malamud Smith, author of My Father is a Book. We are back with Harriet Scott Chessman. Harriet Scott Chessman is the author of the acclaimed novels Lydia Cassatt Reading the Morning Paper and Ohio Angels, as well as The Public is Invited to Dance, a book about Gertrude Stein. She's formerly associate professor of English at Yale University. She's also taught literature and writing at Breadloaf School of English. She's published essays on modern literature, and her current book is Someone Not Really Her Mother, published by Plume. Hi, Harriet.
Hi, Barbara.
Great to have you on. I must say, I have a few pages to go in your book, and I love your book. And I've known exactly where it's been for the past however long I've had the book, a couple of weeks. Now, This morning, I had it in my hand, and when I went to get it to bring it to the show, it's missing.
Oh, not
it's
to worry.
So odd. I don't know what happened to it.
Well, that's actually a good story, because the book is very much about memory.
It is about memory.
And objects that have gone missing.
Yeah, well, it's somewhere, and it's sort of evaporated. But fortunately, I'm familiar with it, because I've sort of what I pick up to read before I go to sleep. I love your imagery, your voice, your characters, and it's such a slim book, that's just full. And I'm so curious how the story came to you and the structure.
Well, actually, I was trying to write short stories at the beginning, and so the first chapter, which is called Once Something, was the first story that I wrote of this series. And it was about this character, Hannah Pearl, who in my mind had early Alzheimer's. But I was very interested in what her world might be like on the inside, how it might feel not to know quite where you were, or who your daughter was, or how she was visiting you, or where you were really going when you went out to lunch with her, and not to mention, you know, what your own history had been. So I started with that character, and I started with a very small story, just 10 or 11 pages. I tend to work pretty small. And as I wrote about Hannah, I became really drawn in to her story, to her life. I wanted to know more than she knew, and in that sense, I had to bring in other characters. I eventually wrote about, there are seven chapters. Four are close over-the-shoulder narration from Hannah's perspective, but then there are two that are from each of her granddaughter's perspective, point of view, and one from her daughter, Miranda. So I was very conscious. If I were sitting right next to you, I'd probably hold up four fingers on one hand and three fingers on the other and make the three interlace with the four, because Hannah begins and ends the book.
So you started with a story,
mm-hmm.
and the story was basically told by Hannah.
Yes, well, it's told in third person, but very, very close.
Yes.
So that you can't know more than Hannah knows, really. Well, you can, actually. You figure out things.
So then did you bring in other characters as needed? I mean, to tell different aspects of the story? Is that how they all
partly.
Sort of came in?
Yes, partly. I wanted to see how Hannah was looked at, how she was seen, and how her life was understood by the people closest to her. Also, how their life had been influenced by her life, but the story of her life, but also the silences in her life. Because as I came to discover, I did not know this at first, but I came to discover that this fictional character left France at the age of 15, right as the Germans were coming into France in 1941, and she emigrated to England, and then from England, after she had her baby, she went to America, and she lived there all her life. And the book actually takes place in the present, in Connecticut. With Hannah trying to understand her world now and having all of the layers of her past history erupt. But what interested me was I felt that she was a woman who had coped with everything by not telling her story, in a sense, by not talking about how her family perished or how much she missed them, how much she missed France, and how much she missed the father of her child, and things like that. She'd coped very, very well all her life, and it's only now, as she has early Alzheimer's, that her earlier life begins to come erupt, in a sense, into the surface. So that's what I was really working with.
Interesting. Now, it feels like such a personal story. And as I was reading, I'm thinking either this comes out of your own life in some way, or you have done so much research and made it such a part of you and digested it so well
I think it's both, actually. I will tell you, there's one chapter towards the end. It's one of Hannah's chapters in which she gets kind of stuck in a drugstore.
Yes.
There are Valentine's cards, and she's wandered away from her assisted living facility, and this story is called Rescue.
Yes.
And I actually was stuck. I was stuck from October of that year until about March or April, because I could not move her past those cards. I think it's because at that point in the writing the story, I realized I did have to know a lot more. I had to learn a lot more about Jews in France at that time, the French history of World War II and the years leading up to it, what it might have been like to grow up in Rouen, which I imagined her growing up in. But I think it was also emotional. I was afraid to go there. I think I had been attracted to this character at first because she had kept everything so much under wraps. So I'm actually glad to hear that it sounds personal, because I think it very much became that.
Mm-hmm.
I felt very, very close to these characters. And yet there wasn't any one character. Well, actually, I shouldn't say that. My grandmother actually was probably the seed of the story, because I visited her just once in the last few years of her life. That sounds odd, but my own family was actually fairly scattered. And when I visited her with my parents, she didn't recognize me. This was the last time I saw her. She was 92, and this was in Illinois. She is not Jewish. She was a Baptist, born and bred in Peoria, Illinois. And she had no idea who I was. And it was such a profound struggle. It was so startling to me. That had never happened to me. And I realized how much my own identity then became questionable, in a sense. And we took her out to lunch. So I do think that's the seed. But I thought, how courageous this woman is. She's not sure even who her stepson is, my father. I could tell she wasn't sure. She looked frightened, but she came with us. And I thought, what courage. And I think it was the courage that I kept questioning and thinking about that led me to a very different character, similar to my grandmother, because my grandmother was a very kind, very composed person who loved language and literature and had been a teacher all her life, but different in that my character Hannah had much more that happened, much more that I knew of, actually, because I could make her up. I don't know what actually happened to my grandmother in her youth, but I could make up what had happened to my fictional character.
You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Harriet Chessman. We're talking about Someone Not Really Her Mother, published by Plume. The ending, did you know where you were going? I'm assuming that you're not a plotter.
That is absolutely right. I am completely not a plotter. The thing is, I work very much out of character and out of voice. And that gets me into trouble sometimes. I think it worked. The way I structured it, that worked for this book, because I like to give myself certain limits I have to work inside. And this one was, each story was about 25 pages in manuscript, and could only occupy about an hour or two on one day of this character's life. But the past had to emerge in a way that was somehow interesting or significant. And through the seven stories, I tried to add bits. Really, the understory was Hannah's story. So what happens at the end of this is that within two pages of the end of the book, you discover how her lover, Russell Pearl, died. And so, in a sense, Hannah, I felt very strongly that Hannah had to reach that memory. Until she reached that memory, her sense of her story wasn't complete. And in that last chapter, it's titled to air world God. I brought in documents because she's been talking about documents or thinking about documents, worried about her documents, having to do with visas and passports, but also having to do with her identity. And she discovers this box in the last chapter. And so one of the strange things is that you hear another voice. You hear her voice in her diary, and you hear Russell Pearl's voice in his letters, and you hear her granddaughter's voices in first person. So it's almost like I thought of the last chapter as a burst of voices, which made a kind of a completion. Her story is complete. And then there's a final irony in that her granddaughter walks in at the very end and sees the diary and says, "Oh, what's this? Oh, is this your diary?" And she puts it all away high up on a shelf that Hannah can't reach. So at that point, we know much more than her granddaughter or possibly her family ever will, unless they can piece together these documents that Hannah herself has just been trying to look at and understand. So I guess I would say it ends in a very mixed note. But I think I work very kinesthetically in a way. I work very much through sound, and I felt I came to the right note at the end.
Will you say more about that in terms of working with sound, through sound, and your process?
I'm fairly new to writing in a sense, in that I had a whole other career earlier as a teacher. And as a teacher of literature, I never quite thought in these terms. So I'm slow to discover how to talk about what I do. But I have discovered that the way I seem to work is that I really have to listen very hard in great quietness to whatever the voice is that I'm creating in the story. And there's the movement of a story often does have to do with an uncovering of a revelation. There's some kind of illumination or insight, but it's fairly quiet. It's more on the level of voice that I know a story's rise and fall, and you know, the end of it. It's a rounding out that I feel, in a sense, and that I want a reader to feel. I know it's hard to put it into language that doesn't sound too abstract. But you know, I used to work very much on Gertrude Stein, and I loved something she used to say. She used to say, anyone can know what a paragraph is by listening to a dog drinking water. Did you ever hear that one?
No, but I love it.
Yeah, she said a dog will. You just listen. They drink. They drink in their own rhythm, and then when they're done, they're done. And she said that's a paragraph. She said anyone can know what a paragraph is, and she said a paragraph is emotional. And I think that's what she meant. There's a bodily movement and a satisfaction to it.
Yeah, it's interesting just learning to listen.
Yeah.
You know, there is a whole process of learning to listen as a writer.
It's hard. Actually, the novel I'm working on now, it's extremely hard. And I have to tell you, I thought I knew how it was going to end. All along, I kept thinking I knew. And about halfway through, I thought, no, I'm not sure. I'm not sure if I can. I'm not sure that's where it's going. And so I think the listening I have to do in this instance is really listening very hard to this character and allowing him to, this in my novel now, allowing him to really emerge and not worry so much about what's someone going to think if this happens, or, you know, I really have to make an effort to push away that those kind of illusory sort of my imaginings about what other people might think. And I don't know why I think that, because actually, you know, in life you can look around. I mean, just on the neighbors on your block, and you think that is, you know, you could write that in a novel, and no one would believe. They would think, oh, that's really fairly impossible to have that happen.
Mm-hmm.
But fiction somehow is different.
Yeah, it is different.
Yeah,
I'd love to hear you read yours.
Oh, okay.
And if you just tuned in, as I like to say at this time, you're a little bit late,
yes.
But we have a few more minutes left with Harriet Scott Chessman, author of Someone Not Really Her Mother, and she's about to read.
Okay. This is from the first chapter, which is called Once Something, and it's in Hannah's point of view. You don't know this at first. You don't know this when you first come to this. It's on the third page, but... she's in the dining room of her assisted living facility in Connecticut, about to have breakfast. And she will come to a line from Ovid that might sound about that's about tears. And she'll also come to a French word, un cadeau, which means a gift. Okay. Breakfast comes after a wait in the dining room. English muffins, says the woman who serves her. The other women are chatting together, but Hannah isn't listening until they say, Hannah, how did you sleep last night? Hannah cannot remember how she slept, so she nods and says, very well, thank you. The woman with bright red hair says, you'll come out with us this morning, won't you, Hannah? We'll ask for permission to take you. It's a gorgeous day for a little walk, a perfect spring day. We could walk just up the block to see the marsh through the trees. Oh, Hannah knows this woman. Of course she does. I think her daughter, Mir, is coming this morning, Helen, says the woman with white hair and dark brown eyes. She's drinking her coffee, black. She is small herself and a little hunched over. When she looks at Hannah, she winks. Hannah spreads butter on her muffin as she eyes the eggs all folded in on each other with smooth walls. She could cook eggs more deliciously than this. A bright picture comes to Hannah of a kitchen, soap suds frothing. Her own hands warm and clean. Something's about to go into the pan. Eggs with a bit of milk, a bit of cheese, and something's baking in the oven. Hannah closes her eyes to see and smell. Little rolls for lunch. Words come floating out of a yeasty ocean. And all in tears she melted, dissolving, queen no longer of those waters. Who wrote this? Hannah loved Ovid in translation, and Shakespeare, a delicious language, English. Did you say something, Hannah? The one with red hair asks, touching Hannah's hand with her own. She's a friend, Hannah's sure now. Both of the women are friends. She melted. Ah, she melted, eh? Sounds like not such a good thing to do, no? Melting is not so good. Hannah smiles. Soon she's sitting in her chair by her bed. Outside the window, the leaves wave, light green new ones. Here in her room is her rug, braided with many colors, and her bed, and her wooden something with round circles one pulls, and her mirror, and, of course, her closet. Inside her closet, she has certain, wait, important documents. One day, possibly, she will look at them. She hopes for their safety. If the young woman with the honeyed hair comes in, Hannah will ask her to check. Maybe she will ask her to hide them. Hannah's hands look like landscapes, moonscapes, with ridges and valleys, changing with movement. She likes looking at them against the color of her skirt, a color like the little round fruits, blood red, purplish, one picks from the tree in the garden, a something, a pit inside. Someone younger picks them with her and drops the basket. Fruits scatter over the grass. How has she come to have a skirt of this color? Maybe the young woman has given it to her. Un cadeau. Inside this language, another waits. Hannah catches glimpses of it, like looking into the windows of a train going slowly past as you stand in the field nearby. Hannah rubs her eyes. She does not like to think of trains. So that's it.
Thank you so much. That was Harriet Scott Chessman reading from Someone Not Really Her Mother. Harriet's website, before I forget to tell you, is harrietchessman.com. You can read about her books and about her and all sorts of things on her lovely website. You have so much poetry in your writing, and as you were reading and listening to you, and I was thinking this as I've been reading the book, I'm imagining that you've taught quite a bit of poetry as well when you were teaching.
Yes, actually, when I had my more scholarly hat on, I used to teach at Yale, and I got to teach all kinds of poetry. Yes.
Don't you think so much of writing is reading, is sort of what you're feeding yourself with?
Absolutely. Do you mean so much of writing comes out of the reading one does?
Yeah, I think so.
I think that's absolutely true. I've noticed that. I think because I came to writing fiction so late, a lot of what I end up writing about actually always seems to come back to my earlier life as someone who just loved reading and loved words and loved talking about it with people. So I actually didn't know that Hannah was going to be thinking now and again about Shakespeare, you know, Shakespeare's sonnets, which weave in and out of her own thoughts, or that kind of thing. But she does. In that way, a lot of my characters are readers. That's why in the novel I'm working on now, though, I have a character who is dyslexic and finds reading very hard. Because for one thing, I wanted to stretch myself and have myself write about someone who doesn't always think about poetry. I do think that as a writer, you have to really push yourself.
When is in your new book? Is there a date that you have to turn it in? And...
No. I'm writing this one essentially on spec.
Mm-hmm.
So I have given myself a deadline for the draft of mid-September.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I can't wait!
Thank you. I can't either. I'll be excited to see how it turns out.
Oh. I have more questions, and we're at the end of our time. So when this book comes out, we'll have to have you on for an hour so we can
that'll be fun.
Talk about that book and talk about Lydia Cassatt.
That's great.
So much else. Any advice, any words of wisdom for the writers who are listening?
To listen to themselves, essentially. Mm. I really think that's it. I mean, both on the level of the language as it comes to you, and on the larger level of the people around you who may not believe that someone that they know could be thinking of writing a story or a book. The thing is, it seems impossible and preposterous in a way. And yet it's the simplest thing, too, if you sit down and start.
Just start.
And keep sitting down.
Yeah, and keep there.
And toss out pages. And don't think that you're going to be, you know, a complete failure if you've had to just chop your manuscript in half, as I have done many, many, many times.
Mm. Well, yeah, I mean, when you write, I think you have to give yourself over to it. And
you do.
See also where it takes you.
Yes. You have to try hard to be open. That's I think, the hardest thing for me, because I tend in my actual life to like to control everything.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I can, that anyone actually can, but it's my impulse.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
For coming on.
Thank you. It was a great honor.
And it's been wonderful reading your book, and now I want to read Lydia Cassatt.
Reading the morning paper, yes.
Yes.
Thank you. Yes, there you go, a reader.
Yes.
Yeah. She's reading Madame Bovary through the book.
Oh, excellent. Okay, yeah. Another reason to read the book.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
That was Harriet Chessman, author of Someone Not Really Her Mother, published by Plume. Seriously, so much else I would have liked to talk with Harriet about regarding that book, so she will have to come back and stay for the entire hour. I guess that's it. If you want to know more about the show, go to penonfire.com. You can email me from there if you'd like weekly updates. And I'm going to leave you with a quote by Jane Smiley, who said, "I simply don't know how anyone can write at great speed and only for the money's sake." Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Pen on Fire is my book, and be with us next week. Thank you.